From Chicago, this is Inside Politics, a weekly program of political discussion and intrigue with occasional injection of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, power brokers, and public servants from beyond the Beltway. Your host is Bruce Dumont.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Inside Politics, offering a weekly analysis of the national political headlines, which this week include Dick Thornburgh upset in Pennsylvania Senate race, a Republican is elected governor of Mississippi, Washington State says no to term limitation proposal, Dan Rostenkowski offers middle-class tax cut that could benefit 90 million Americans. Those stories, plus some thoughts on the Republican time bomb ticking in Louisiana. But first, a few words about Inside Politics for those of you who are listening to this program for the very first time. The program began in June of 1980 on WBEZ in Chicago, where the program originates from each week. It began as an experiment, a 13-week experiment to cover the 1980 presidential campaign, and it was an experiment that worked. And since 1980, Inside Politics has been a popular program here in Chicago, one of the most political cities in America. Its format features robust, noisy, in-your-ear, heated discussion. It's not for the weak or faint of heart, and I can guarantee that it will offend some people, but so be it. Passionate political debate frequently does in this country. I believe that in this fast-changing world, more people should become involved in the process that selects our leaders, and Inside Politics is a program that respects the players from all factions on the political playing field. And to those on the sidelines, we offer very little sympathy. In fact, you're frequently browbeaten on this program. We also offer our weekly analysis from beyond the Washington, D.C. Beltway, free from the social circuit of like-thinking leaders and occasional like-thinking journalists as well. Inside Politics will offer insights from those far from the seat of Washington, D.C. power, but in my view, no less informed an insight. We feel that Washington, D.C. does not have a monopoly on good ideas or expert analysis. However, this is not a program that is going to be built on Washington bashing. We will be here for the next 52 weeks, checking the political pulse of America as voters sort out the issues and the candidates for Campaign 92. What is ahead for us? It will be 52 weeks of ups and downs, a variety of changes on the political landscape, and George Bush wants to define what a new world order is. We may offer a piece of advice from here in the city of Chicago, and as we check the pulse from around America for the next 52 weeks. Tonight we take that first step down the road to Election Night 92, and we're very glad that you're with us for that first step. And joining me on our first week to share their thoughts and opinions, we first welcome a man who was on this very first program in June of 1980 and has been on virtually every program since that time, one of the most outspoken commentators in the city of Chicago, conservative stripe, former corporate lobbyist, president of his own consulting firm and founder of the Republican Assembly of Illinois, Tom Rosier. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you.
Grace Kamiquitz, you're so calm.
I am.
You're on good behavior.
I think he's nervous.
Grace Kamiquitz, a Democratic political consultant. She's a member of the steering committee of the National Women's Political Caucus, a freelance political columnist whose column appears in Crane Chicago Business here in the city of Chicago. And we also welcome Chris Bowman, who's political advisor to Labor Secretary Lynn Martin. He was a consultant to her 1990 Senate campaign. He's a former reporter from Rockford, Illinois, and he was a former high school student of Lynn Martin, so they go back a long way politically. Chris was director of political operations for the Republican National Committee and the former deputy executive director of the National Republican Congressional Committee. Grayson Mitchell also joins us. He is president of his own public relations firm. He is a former Washington Bureau reporter for the Los Angeles Times, a former political reporter for the Washington Post and the Chicago Sun-Times, and also he was the first press secretary to the late Mayor Harold Washington, Chicago's first African-American mayor. We have a feature on this program called Know and Tell, that part of our program where we ask each guest each week to share with us for the first time something that they know that they now want to tell, and any relationship to this and truth is purely coincidental in many cases, but frequently it is accurate, and we begin this week with Tom Rosier. Tom, what's your Know and Tell?
Know and Tell is that the White House inside coterie has decided that David Duke is going to become the next governor of Louisiana, and they had a strategy meeting today in the White House, where, in fact, there was a debate between Roger Ailes and a number of other people, Roger Ailes saying that you shouldn't back away entirely from David Duke because he's embraced a lot of things that Reagan and Bush have talked about on a non-racist side, and the other side says, no, you should entirely repudiate him, and Roger Ailes will win. They will, in fact, not embrace David Duke, but they won't back away from him that much.
How much can you not back away when you said, when Bush said he wouldn't vote for him?
Well, but that was...
He'd vote for Edwards if he were living in Louisiana.
We're talking
well,
about...
Well, he didn't say he was going
to... He didn't listen to the no and tell.
It's part of that New World Order.
Yeah, that's part of the New World Order. Part of the New World Order is you vote for the Democrat in Louisiana. Grace Kamikowicz, tell us something that you know and you now want to tell.
Janet Napolitano, an attorney from Phoenix, is forming an exploratory committee to gain the Democratic nomination for senator. There are two retired military people who are interested in it, but they are not serious candidates, so she will probably...
According to you, they're not serious candidates.
No,
in their own mind, perhaps they are.
No, not in the mind of the Democratic Party of Arizona.
Well, we know
the thing that's
Party
interesting...
Besides everything outside of Dennis DeConcini, who's going bye-bye.
Are you through yet? Because I'm not through.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. The kicker is she was inspired to run against John McCain because she was at the Judiciary Committee hearings as one of the legal advisors to Anita Hill.
Very interesting. Grayson Mitchell, tell us something that you know that you now want to tell.
Well, I hear that Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton may have trouble living up to his squeaky clean image.
Squeaky clean image.
There are some
very squeaky clean.
Yeah, there's
Tom is more than happy to pour a little dirt on that.
I know it gladdens Tom's heart, and I even hate to throw it to him. It's such a
soft. My heavens, what is his problem?
Apparently, there are some things that
he
some reporters are digging
exam.
Into. I can't speak to that, but there are some disclosures, I'm told, that'll come out that'll test how well the governor and his handlers can handle damage control.
Oh.
And if not handled successfully...
But hasn't that been going on for...
Personal professional?
Kind of spill over from both. Personal, that spills over to professional as well.
All right. Mm. Does it have anything to do with the widely circulated rumors about extramarital affairs?
This is not what's my line. I can't... Next question, please.
That's five down and ten. Dorothy Kilgallen.
She just left.
Chris Bowman.
Literally.
Chris Bowman, tell us
not
something that you know that you now want to tell.
I'm interested in who Tom Roser talks to and who I do. I was also told about a meeting in the White House today, or discussions in the White House today, as a result of the Pennsylvania race and other information that there's a group in there that does not want Roger Ailes as a part of the campaign in 1992. They feel he's too much of a negative now, and that it was his entire strategy behind the Thornburg campaign, and they're going to be urging that he not be a part of it.
Very interesting.
We heard out of the White House for a long time.
Yeah, lots of news.
Another 1,000 points of life.
Joining us now on our inaugural program nationwide, we welcome a well-known name in American political journalistic circles. He is David Broder, Washington Post syndicated political columnist who appears in 300 newspapers around the United States, a winner of the 1973 Pulitzer Prize for commentary, now in his 25th year with the Washington Post, former writer for Congressional Quarterly and author of four books on politics and journalism, and a native of Chicago Heights and a graduate of the University of Chicago. David, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Now, with your know-and-tell, we want to get your reaction. What do you know that you now want to tell us?
What I hear, though I don't know it, is that former California Governor Jerry Brown, who is now running for president in the Democratic primaries, is taking great encouragement from Tuesday's voting results, thinks that there really is an anti-politics, anti-party trend in the country, and is increasingly giving thought to the possibility of becoming the John Anderson of 1992. Mm-hmm. In other words, sort of trying it out for a little while, but not very long, in the Democratic primaries, and then announcing that you can't run inside either of these political parties. They're both so corrupt.
David,
so
does that mean that he'll be
third party?
Does that mean he'll be teaching at Florida State in about 2 or 3 years, Civics 101?
Well, he is a lawyer. It's possible there could be a new law firm of Anderson.
David, do you think there's any there's anything out there in the body politic that would indicate that America might be ripe for a third party at this moment in time?
Well, there is tons of stuff out there that says that people are pretty fed up with conventional politicians. Whether Jerry Brown or somebody can harness that is a different question. I think Brown has some credibility problems himself in playing that role, but there is certainly a wave out there for somebody to ride.
He was on this program a couple of weeks ago, and I was pleasantly surprised. I think before the program, I think we were all wondering whether, notwithstanding a retraction from Mike Royko, that he was a Governor Moonbeam. He seemed to be a little more down-to-earth on that program. Tom,
very
what was
grounded.
Your reaction? Because you were in debate, heated debate with him for most of the program.
Well, we were talking about the three conditions that make mortal sense: sufficient reflection, grievous matter, full consent of the will. He flunked on one, which is grievous matter, but he's a politician. But the whole thing that I want to say is that I was
all right in mortal sin, though.
That's right. I was impressed with him. But I would ask David this question: didn't he figure pretty heavily, David, in the state of Washington, actually against term limitations, because he was campaigning there, and people said this is the California syndrome?
I think that's right, Tom. And they made very good use of his ill-timed visit there, because, as you know, the opponents of term limits were using the argument that California would just love to see us give up our leverage in the Congress, because they would then be able to come in, grab our water and whatever else they might want with the massive numbers of their congressional delegation.
When you look at the Democratic field at this moment in time, what is your assessment of who is the most likely to succeed at this moment?
I have no idea. I don't think we've seen enough of these folks interacting with voters outside their home states to be able to make that judgment. At least I can.
Chris Bowman?
Dave, the assessment outside the Beltway, again, as we've been saying, is that Cuomo's going to get in. We keep hearing this over and over and over. And that I think that actually, and I don't care, but it has a chilling effect on the rest of the field. What's your prediction or your best guess?
I gave up trying to get Mario Cuomo's mind in a particular day in 1987 after I'd interviewed him in his office at the top of the World Trade Center. Riding down the elevator, I was literally talking to myself. And I said, this guy is too subtle, too clever for me. I'm just going to have to wait for him to say it. I think he will say it exactly a week from tonight. He's doing the radio call-in show there on which he announced 4 years ago that he was not going to run for president. I think we got 7 days to wait. My own bet is, if I had to bet, that he will probably not run. But he's clearly taken a more serious look at it. And
particularly after Tuesday night,
enough people have talked who know him much better than I do tell me that he'd really like to do it, but there's a difference between liking to do it. Jay Rockefeller wanted to run, but ended up not running.
Grace?
Yeah, you know, Roger Stone had an interesting piece in the Times yesterday about Cuomo being the Republicans' best dream, about being the easiest to beat. Do you buy into that?
His record in New York gives him lots of targets, but Mario Cuomo is a larger-than-life size figure. And in terms of somebody who you could imagine taking the stage for a debate with George Bush without having his knees knocked, that's Mario Cuomo.
Tom, you have been a big supporter of Mario Cuomo over the years.
Oh, that's a little strong.
No. Tom has been on the record.
Admirer,
on this
but not
no,
supporter.
No, I would say, well, supportive in that he would be the strongest candidate for the Democrats.
I thought he was a great example of an outstanding candidate. I watched him last night on C-SPAN, and the thing that occurred to me, David, is that he may be too smart to be president. You know, as you recall, Walter, I think you, David, and I are the only ones old enough to remember that Walter Lippmann said that Franklin Roosevelt had a third-rate intellect and a first-rate personality. When I saw Mario Cuomo answer people in New York, putting them down and everything else with stunning array of statistics, do you feel he's too smart to be president?
I think he's awfully his mind is too complex almost to make an ideal candidate. But the thing that struck me about that interview last night, Tom, I don't know what your reaction was, when he said that he'd like to get advice from three people before he decides, and the three people were Walter Mondale, Jimmy Carter, and Richard Nixon.
That's right.
I mean, that's pretty weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Grayson Mitchell's got a question or comment.
David, do you have any idea what must be the three or four prominent factors in Cuomo's mind as he sits there and tries to mull over his decision?
What he's talking with people about is what happens. His budget is in a mess, as is many other governors, as are many other governors. And he's got to call his legislature back into special session. He's trying to figure out whether he can deal with that and run for president, what the reaction would be if he gave up the governorship, which he's talked with some people about, to run for president. He's got a lot of hard choices to make.
You know, he won't start the campaign.
Personal questions. Does he think he could be president? Is he willing to take it on? I think the answer to both those questions is yes.
4 years ago, when there was much discussion as to whether or not he would or would not get into the race, there was some feeling that got some currency that perhaps in the in an era of proctoscopic political reporting, that maybe he had something to hide, and that that's why he didn't really get into the race. Is there any credence to that?
I don't buy that theory myself.
Chris?
No, I don't buy that either. I mean, that's like the rumors that go that you hear from many, many, many campaigns.
Rumors in the bar.
Right. I think that what an advantage he has, ironically, that Dukakis didn't have is there's no New York miracle like Massachusetts miracle. I think it's what Tom said is the key point, is this guy has the charisma or the chutzpah or whatever you want to call it to run for president against George Bush. And like David said, his knees wouldn't knock in a debate.
And they know that in Phoenix, and they know it in San Francisco, and they know it in Helena and all over the United States.
And he would Mario frame Cuomo is not Bill Clinton, or he's not like any of these other governors that are or senators that are running. He is bigger than the rest of the Democratic field.
I think he would frame the problems of New York State on the federal government's shifting of responsibilities to the states, and has a lot of sympathy with that.
Let's spend some time talking about what happened in Pennsylvania this week.
Oh,
Harris
yes.
Wolford, the incumbent, soundly defeated former two-term Republican governor, once the darling of the Republican Party, Dick Thornburgh, in Pennsylvania in an unprecedented political upset for Pennsylvania.
10 points.
That is viewed as rejection of White House domestic policy, and not since 1962 has a Democrat been elected to serve the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in the U.S. Senate. Chris Bowman, what was your reaction to not only Thornburgh's defeat, which I think you suggested might be on the horizon, but, I mean, the way in which he was defeated, he was swamped.
Yes, he was swamped. But I think the story really of Tuesday was, it wasn't a partisan story. In fact, if you want to sit down and look at the races, Republicans could be happy. I think they shouldn't be, though. The real story here was scaring of the incumbents. George Bush ought to pay attention, but anybody else who's in I said Republican, George Bush ought to be scared, but any incumbent ought to be afraid of what they saw on Tuesday. Pennsylvania, frankly, was the same as Mississippi. Incumbents were swept out. Thornburgh ran a campaign as an incumbent, and I believe that the message from the voters were they were fed up. Thornburgh, frankly, ran a very poor campaign, and one of my best friends ran that campaign, and I will still say it, and they shouldn't have run it as an incumbent. And
he didn't steal Lynn Martin's campaign book, did he?
Well,
you didn't sell that Lynn Martin campaign book to him, did you? Tell us the truth.
Same
now,
media
come
advisor?
Come on. Is it true?
There were a couple of the same people in there. No. We didn't run as an incumbent. But I think the way that they ran that campaign was wrong. But there was a message being sent to George Bush. As he's sitting in Rome now, I think he's going to be saying, frankly, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
Looking,
domestic issues are on the agenda.
Looking at the issues that were used by Republican Kirk Fordyce, who was the new governor-elect of Mississippi in defeating Ray Mobus Tuesday, is this perhaps a concern for Republicans, do you think, Tom?
No, not at all. I think that the issues that he used were those which are concerning a lot of people in the middle class, a lot of people who, in fact, are not to be called racist, but are concerned about affirmative action and the and deleterious effects of affirmative action. And I think that that has nothing to do with any kind of charge of racism. Our Democratic liberal friends say that racism appends to anyone, whoever asks any questions about whether affirmative action
but
can
he,
work.
But he also ran anti-welfare.
He was not anti-welfare. What he was talking about was the need for welfare reform.
He was against the 1965 civil rights bill.
He said he was against the 1965 civil rights bill if it applied only to Mississippi and the South and not to the nation.
What's your reaction, Grayson?
First of all, I want to just differ a little bit here. I think that the message from Pennsylvania was a wake-up call at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
That's right.
I think there's no question that there is a tide against incumbents across the country, but I think the message in Pennsylvania is a little bit more pointed than that. I think given the fact that the White House prestige was on the line, the fact that Thornburg was supposed to form a governor and a former AG and so closely tied to the White House, I think Bush's name was right there on the ballot along with Thornburg. And I think that that was a double message sent from Pennsylvania.
What were the messages that you saw and read, David?
I agree with both what Grayson just said and what Chris had said earlier. There is an anti-incumbent, send them a message kind of psychology out there. But Pennsylvania was pointed in a particular direction, and the direction was the Republicans and the White House. A friend of mine up there, a Republican up there, said, you know, George Bush could win the presidency without carrying Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania's economy is not that different today from California's. And having been in California for 5 or 6 days just 2 weeks ago, I think he's absolutely right. What's happening is that the loss of industrial jobs, which first affected blue-collar workers, is now affecting white-collar, middle management people. They are scared, and that is right out of the heart of the Republican constituency. Thornburg lost traditional Republican bedroom counties in Pennsylvania. And if they don't understand that that's a problem in the White House, they're not paying attention.
Well, I agree with that.
But I'd like, excuse me,
Grace,
Tom,
go ahead.
I don't step on my lines. What I'd like to know is what did Ray Flynn and Kirchmoak do that made them 70%+ winners as opposed to all the other mayors and all the other incumbents who had such problems? What was so special about? No, well, Boston's got a lot of problems. Do you know that, Dave?
The answer is the same as what made Rich Daley so strong, looked so strong this past winter in Chicago. If you're dealing inside a Democratic constituency in a big city, the incumbent mayor, if he's done a decent job, can basically dry up all opposition, and that's what those two incumbent mayors did.
Are we going to see more of the president talking about domestic policy and picking up on what transpired, Chris, in your view?
I think the fact is, and Dave could articulate this better than I think, the fact that they really did a reverse and canceled that trip to Asia was very significant, and I think signified, I don't know if there was any internal White House fighting over that, I don't know that, but the fact that they reverse field on that and said that they were doing it because Congress was in session, when we all know that the president has gone on several trips when Congress has been
Chris,
in session.
Chris, I hate to disagree with you, but it isn't just canceling a trip to Asia. It is canceling the tenure of Richard Darman.
Right.
And it is canceling the tenure of Nick Brady and putting into effect the ideas of Jack Kemp, which are really the Reagan ideas, which call for tax cuts and, if I may say so, something Reagan didn't do, which is cutting the budget and cutting spending. That's the thing that Republicans stand for. And unfortunately, Thornburg came on as under Eisenhower, all kinds of cabinet officers were sent out to run and lost because they stood for a kind of namby-pamby, mushy moderate, mashed potato sandwich Republicanism, which doesn't stand
but
for anything.
Did,
and you know, Dick
actually,
Dick Thornburg didn't stand for a thing because when he was head of the Kennedy School of the Kennedy Institute of Politics, he was a liberal. And you know, actually yourself, David, you wrote that he became an overnight conservative and then a moderate. This guy doesn't stand for anything, does he?
Isn't that the argument going on in the White House right now, which kind of economics they're going to pursue?
That's right, but I mean, we ought to find
Dan
a president who understands what it is.
Has Dan Rostenkowski, in your view, David Broder, Has he perhaps stolen the tax issue back from the Republicans with his suggestions today on top of suggestions that have been made by Lloyd Benson?
I don't know who's got custody at the moment. My guess is
well, he's got the headline this morning.
That is a hot
he's
potato.
The Robin Hood.
That'll be passed around many times because, in truth, nobody can be sure. I mean, we're running a deficit of close to $300 billion. And the idea that by cutting taxes another $10 billion, you're somehow going to give a real shot in the arm to the economy just doesn't add up, I think.
Well, David, that shows that you're, although you're a very nice University of Chicago graduate, you're not in the University of Chicago School of Economics, because were you a graduate of the University School of Economics, you would say that that tax cut would cause growth, which in fact will start eating up the deficit.
I had problems keeping awake in those economics.
What about the political appeal, however, of a proposal that will provide 80% of U.S. households, 90 million homes, estimated 90 million homes, with a $200 to $400 a year income tax credit financed by raising taxes on the rich and really hitting, another 1% on the, another 10% on the, on the top 1%? I mean, does that not have political appeal, even though it may not be sound?
Political appeal. I don't, whether it has any economic benefit is another question.
Nothing would happen.
It's got great political appeal, and it'll probably make no economic difference at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, on that note, David Broder, thank you very much for joining us this week on Inside Politics.
Thanks, Dave.
David Broder, Washington Post syndicated political columnist, who has joined us along with Tom Roser, Grace Kamekiewicz, Chris Bowman, and Grayson Mitchell. I'm Bruce Dumont. You're listening to Inside Politics, coming to you from Chicago on the Inside Politics Radio Network. We continue from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. This is Inside Politics. Joining us this week, Tom Roser, Grace Kamekiewicz, Chris Bowman, and Grayson Mitchell. If you would like to participate on the future broadcast, then are offering your hand to have your political pulse taken on this program, you can drop us a postcard. Inside Politics, 105 West Adams Street, 40th floor, Chicago, Illinois, 60603. And if you're not taking shorthand, I will repeat that a little bit later on. Each week, we will be going to the phone lines to check the political pulse of America. And Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Bruce, how you doing?
Fine.
What I wanted to bring up, Bruce, was the issue of abortion in the latest results.
One of Tom's favorite subjects.
I know. He's a great guy.
He's a great American.
He is a great American.
Call him.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, first of all, the guy down in Louisiana, Romer, would be governor next week if he hadn't vetoed that abortion bill.
Do you agree with that, Tom?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't.
Continue.
That's nonsense.
Okay.
Let him finish.
All right,
let him finish.
The second thing is Wofford is pro-life. If he were pro-abortion, Thornburg would have won.
Disagree.
All right,
Pennsylvania, keep going.
Would have won. And where is the predictability of you know, where is this great pro-choice majority in this country?
Right.
Washington State is a very liberal state. I mean, it went to caucus last election, if I'm not mistaken. And look what happened. Look what happened there.
I mean, we don't know what happened.
Now, wait a minute.
The fact of the matter is that if you're paying attention to the vote at all, Tom, you'll know that it's still undecided.
I'm still undecided.
And not only that, that just shows you that this issue is a volatile issue.
I'm going to fight for the right of this guy to calls up, the little fellow. I'm fighting for the right of little fellow to make his point, and I think the little fellow...
He hasn't yet.
Point is that the state of Washington is a overwhelmingly liberal state.
No, it isn't.
This social issue...
It is not.
...which has won, generally speaking, although there are some votes out, for the pro-life side.
Grace.
Besides defeating death with dignity.
Grace.
Well, that's the reason,
as a matter of fact. Exactly the reason they're tied together.
Because the euthanasia thing was so high on the Richter scale that it brought out all the right-to-lifers who also voted against the abortion thing.
Grace, let me tell you.
What kills me is you always have articles in the press about how the Republicans are concerned about the choice issue. And you'll get some turncoat Republican saying, we're really concerned about this. This was an article in the Tribune today about how the president really should moderate his position on abortion. But when it comes down to actually getting the pulse of the people, when you listen to the Gallup polls instead of suppressing the press...
You know what gets me so mad about people who are pro-life, and I happen to be pro-choice, that if they win one thing, they think that is 100% victory. Fact of the matter is the abortion issue is split among the American electorate. And there are about 20% of the people that are pro-choice, about 20% of the people are pro-life,
The
rest really
don't care about
they don't care about it. Or it depends how
they care about other issues.
They care about how the issue is worded on a ballot, too.
And
this euthanasia thing... This euthanasia thing really affected that vote.
That's right. You're not going to step on Meyer holes. I'm 63.
Go ahead.
Well, let me tell you this.
Euthanasia right here.
That's right.
And what about the youth in America?
Youth in Europe and youth in the United States.
What about the youth in America?
What I want to tell you is this, that I think the caller is pretty fundamentally right. We know that we're on the losing side, generally speaking, nationally in this issue. But if pro-choice had won overwhelmingly in Washington, D.C., it'll be number one on Peter Jennings and on the cover of Time and Newsweek. And what's happening when we win, we're not getting covered from
campaign.
The liberal media, folks.
One at a time, last word to you, Mark, then we're moving on.
Okay, the latest Gallup poll, which was completely ignored in the press, and if it had been the other way, it would have been trumpeted for a week, was that 42% were firmly pro-life, 33% were pro-choice. That's the latest and largest ever poll on pro-life and pro-choice in this country.
Mark,
and that's just a fact.
I love you, Mark.
I don't want to ignore the facts.
It's totally dependent on how it's worded.
How the question is worded.
This is a big liberal state went pro-life, and you guys don't want to talk about it.
Grace has got the floor.
Well, I think the other part that's absolutely absurd is the sudden embracement of so-called pro-life by the Republican Party. When the truth is, because for years and years and years, the point of the Republican Party was to keep government off your back. Ronald Reagan decided that he needed the pro-life group in order to win, embraced it, and it became part of your platform.
Rewriting history.
And now, are you kidding?
We're moving on. Mark,
Go ahead. The perception of Washington being a liberal state is wrong. It is a populist state. It is not a liberal state.
Scoop Jackson was certainly not.
I have to agree with him on that.
Warren Magnuson and all those people.
They're a populist.
Eric,
you're on Inside Politics. Thanks for joining us this week.
Thank you, Bruce. This is a good show for the national audience to hear, I guess. It sounds like Washington is a key part of the subject matter for
Washington
tonight.
State and Washington, D.C.
Washington,
we don't bash either one of them.
My question is on Washington State. It's two parts. It's on the term limitation question, which, as probably most of the listeners know, went down to defeat in Washington. First of all, my first question is, how much influence do you think Tom Foley may have had on the proposition?
Big.
And second of all, what will the advocates of term limitation do now with the most publicized defeat to term limitation having occurred?
Grayson Mitchell, what do you think?
Oh, I think the issue in Washington was skewed primarily because of the Speaker of the House. Very few states want to give up that kind of clout. Plus, Foley is a very enlightened official. He came in with very heavily with his own prestige. I don't think the defeat in Washington is going to take the air out of the sail.
I agree with that.
Yeah,
I think it's aberrational.
That's
unanimous.
I think it's just you.
If I could just agree with Grace, and you don't mind if I do that. It happens about every year.
It happens so rarely, yeah.
I don't want to step on that line.
If you have a Speaker of the House nationally who's a very important person with, in fact, Washington State fighting with California over all kinds of rights and all these things. Sure, they voted their pocketbook. But that will not stop, and Grayson is so totally right, I'm stunned. He absolutely is prescient.
Stupid
what has happened is that term limitation is going to continue in this country, and it's going to be a very serious
politics. I will even take Tom's and take it further.
Oh,
I think this was a boost for it nationally, because what the Washington voters were saying is, we're not going to do this alone. We want this to happen. Tom Foley made it himself, and he made it regional. But it clearly, when it was so close,
and
that it could have easily have passed if he didn't put his name and his state on the line.
And
City.
I think the other thing is, if they made it, if they didn't make it retroactive, it might have even passed this time.
Right.
All right. Thanks very much,
Mayor,
Eric. Last word to you.
Can I throw one more thing in?
Yep.
There already is a term limitation bill that's been passed in Colorado, with. The limits are not going to be in place until later on in the decade.
I think 1998 or something.
Has there been talk of a court fight through federal courts on this question?
Yeah, there has, with a number of people. Bruce Fine on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, a lawyer from Harvard who happens to support this thing, says it can be. It's not decided, obviously. It's going to be a constitutional fight. Generally speaking, the leading lights think that the states have a right to decide the limitations for their congressmen, and that's going to be a very great fight.
Let me just add one more thing to what Eric's saying. This is going to be one of the biggest issues, I think, as you look to the 92 campaign. You're going to have Quayle go out front for it for the Bush campaign, and you're going to have Bob Custra going out for it.
Lieutenant
Governor Bob Custer is going to go out with this issue in Illinois. So this issue by no means is dead, and Washington didn't hurt it at all.
Well, I hope, speaking for myself and hopefully for many other people who believe the same as I do, I hope it dies on the vine, because I think it's very dangerous.
Good for you.
And I don't think we know what this is going to do, and I think we've had 200 years of democracy and democratic tradition to indicate that this is dangerous and that we should continue doing what we're doing now.
Yeah, it's using a cannon to kill a gnat.
But that is the real issue there. And I think personally,
well, you got to get their attention.
That's exactly it. I'm telling
you,
there's no way to get the incumbents' attention. You remember 10 years ago, Grace, what it took here was cutting back the size of the House by a third.
And we know what that did. By the way, we should mention that what Chris is referring to is a move to reduce the size of the Illinois House of Representatives, and a recommendation that by doing that, that government would be improved, that the cost of government would be greatly reduced, and neither happened.
There's one third fewer.
Except there's you know, they got more room to walk between the aisles. Eric, thank you very much. And believe
and
me,
more wages. To
some of those lawmakers need the extra room. Bob, you're on Inside Politics. Thanks for standing by.
Yeah, I got a couple of questions. One thing I'd like all of the members of the panel to sort of pontificate for just a few seconds. I know that's impossible for Tom.
Only Tom pontificates.
What would you all do? What would you recommend to your candidate if you were their campaign manager? The second thing I wanted to raise is, even if they confiscate all the money from all the millionaires in the country, there still isn't enough to solve our problems. So this tax break for the middle class, this sounds more like smoke and mirrors to me. I would dearly love to have nationalized health insurance, even though I'm basically conservative about these things. But hey, you know, screw ideology. Let's do what works.
Now, the advice on candidates?
The advice on candidates, like if for George Bush...
Here's what I want to do. I want to ask our Democrats to put their partisanship aside
And I want the Democrats on the show this week to give the advice to President Bush on what he should run on. And I want to ask our Republicans, what message would they hand to whoever the Democratic nominee is? And we will turn to you, Mr. Mitchell, because you have been known to put a few words in candidates' mouths over the years. What words would you put in President Bush's mind, Mr. Democrat?
Needs to identify with hardship and fear that, voters are feeling, regardless of station in life. He needs to also be a part of the solution, not part of the problem, which means that he needs to quickly be seen, photographed, sitting around a lot of vinyl kitchen tables with Americans brooding about hard times. He needs to also be out there with blue-collar workers and white-collar workers. He needs to sign on to the tax cut because it is smoke and mirrors. Nothing sounds better than voters who are feeling pocketbook crunches in campaigns and then talk about putting more money in on the kitchen table. In other words, it needs to do a 180 reversal, show pretty pictures, frankly, identify with the common plight.
Grace.
He needs to stay put in the first place, come back and not leave the country again.
Put his passport away.
Yeah, come up with a... Does he use a passport? Come up with a
national... I think he has to go through airport security.
He needs to come up with a health plan. If he doesn't believe in national health insurance, then he has to come up with some sort of way of getting a real good fix on health care costs, and that doesn't mean shoving the responsibility back to the states. And
read my lips. Lower doctors' bills.
Well, it's not even doctor bills. They're cheap compared with hospitals.
Can we have Tom Roser give some advice to Jerry Brown?
Jerry Brown?
I
would take Mario Cuomo with all his forensic and all his articulation gifts, and I'd have a frontal lobotomy committed upon him, and I would instill in his brain, instead of that wondrous articulate brain that he has, I would put in the economic ideas of Paul Tsongas, including capital gains, and I would have this man go out and I'd have him fight for more jobs based on capital gains, and I would elect the next Democratic president of the United States.
Whatever happened to Paul
Tsongas?
It's
really smoke and mirrors. It has an effect for 2 years, and then it doesn't trickle down. It doesn't do any good. It shuts off. That is just nonsense.
You mentioned Paul Tsongas. Has anybody seen him
in the past?
Well,
Chris, what advice would you give to the Democrats?
I think I would just tag on to what Grayson said, that any Democrat ought to look at Bush is clearly vulnerable on the focusing on the foreign affairs issue. I'd get Carl Malden on there maybe and show him a picture of some homeless people and say, hey, President Bush, don't leave home. Mm-hmm. Or if you do, don't leave home without this. Secondly, I would show a picture, I'd talk about foreign affairs, and I'd show a picture of a very healthy Saddam Hussein and waving to him, hi, George, I'm still here.
Mm-hmm. How does this actually solve any problems, though?
It doesn't. Just wins elections.
It doesn't.
Okay,
but I tell you,
George Bush hasn't solved any problems.
I tell you, the caller has asked us.
I have a suggestion for George Bush. He's very pragmatic. I mean, he's not a stupid man. We may not agree with all of his policies.
Absolutely.
I predict that next spring there are going to be a couple of million construction workers put back to work on highway and infrastructure jobs. They're going to find the money for it somehow. He's going to sign the thing for the unemployment benefit extension. That's going to pump a little more money and maybe raise some consumer confidence that, you know, things aren't going to run out completely. Somebody mentioned a week or so ago about on December 6, 1941, we were in the middle of a depression, and on December 8th, we were, like, you know, geared up, going to war, and everybody was back at work. It's all psychological, isn't it?
I would agree with him, too, that... A year ago, I mean, this was a slam dunk.
Are you suggesting we stay out of Hawaii in December?
No, I'm suggesting that if George Bush does, you know, a fireside chat of some kind and says, look, you know, we're gonna borrow money for infrastructure. This is something that will pay back, and it's not like borrowing money to pay ongoing expenses like for welfare or defense or whatever. There are other things that he can do by rearranging some of the priorities, but...
Okay, Bob, we got to move on. Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Bernie out in Los Angeles, California. How are you, Bernie? Go ahead.
Okay, Bruce.
What's happening out there?
Yeah, real good. In an article last Sunday in the Los Angeles Times, Robert Beckel wrote, Waiting for Mario, We saved the Democrats. Well, the thrust of it is that he may not save them, but if I could just read one line. In 1992, the Democratic Party desperately needs an outsider, a candidate who can take advantage of the anti-establishment mood raging in the country. That ain't Mario. I think it might be, and my question is, in the light of Democrat Harris Wolford's impressive win in Pennsylvania over Richard Thornburg, Bush's pal, do you think the Democrats, and more specifically Mario Cuomo, will have the guts to run and run hard against George Bush, a guy which I think can be beaten if the Democrats put the president's feet to the fire and run a campaign okay. driven by strong social issues?
Tom, I think that I think reluctantly, because I like people who use language beautifully, I think reluctantly Mario Cuomo is not the guy as a result of last night's performance. He was telling people from New York on C-SPAN that they ought to shut up and understand that New York is going through a resurgence. Everything is lovely. He cited statistics, and it was very unconvincing. He's brilliant. He's a tremendous locutionary. He's absolutely outstanding. He ought to deliver speech lessons, but he is not a candidate for president because he's too brilliant.
Well, I think
what about your former governor who was a guest on this program a couple of weeks ago, and that's Jerry Brown. How well would he do next year in his home state?
Well, I think Brown, but I really want to talk about Cuomo, but I think both Brown and Cuomo speak to Democrats and speak about social issues that the Democrats, the middle class...
Yeah, but Brown blames the Democrats for a lot of the problems. Right. He acknowledged that the Democrats are...
run against the incumbents.
Yeah, you run against everybody.
It's a new Democratic Party, perhaps, but my point is that the Democrats speak about the social issues, about what the middle class want to hear. You know, gentlemen, that if Jesse Jackson were white, he'd be in the White House. I point to the Michigan primary, where he went across the boards in that primary when he's running for president.
Do you agree with that, Grayson?
He cut across all issues because he spoke to the Democrats.
Bernie, let me ask. Grayson Mitchell, do you agree with that? If Jesse Jackson was white, that he would be president of the United States?
I think there's something to that. I think if you look at where he came from and you also look at the number of votes that he attracted, I think you could make a strong argument. However, you could also make a counter-argument that given the platform, given the populism, and given the issues that he had staked out, he had pretty much capped out what that constituency represented vote-wise.
Chris, what do you think?
I don't agree with that at all. If Jesse Jackson were white, he wouldn't have had a platform at all. I think he was... I was sorry to see that he decided not to run.
So was Tom.
I think that
I was sad, Tom. You were
I really think finally Jesse Jackson could have had major impact on the political process if he decided.
Well, I have never been known as a big Jesse Jackson fan.
Yes,
however,
true.
I wanted really, you know, I got so angry during all the Clarence Thomas nonsense of this. Clarence Thomas is the guy who is the up from your bootstraps type of thing, and people forgot what Jesse Jackson's message has been right along, which is self-help. He certainly has asked for government programs and support, but he's always been someone who said, stay in school, learn, work,
yourself.
That's
what I'm saying. Well, his timing might have been right.
Let me tell you what the great demagogic answer was, which was last night on C-SPAN, and it wasn't from Mario Cuomo, and it ought to be in the book. David Duke versus Edwin Edwards debating. Edwin Edwards called upon him to renounce racism, which, in fact, he had every strong moral thing to do. You know what this kid said? I will do it when Jesse Jackson says he is sorry for spitting in the salads that he worked on in the restaurants. Now, I resented that. But you know what that meant? Look at what the power of that was over the national news yeah. thing. This guy, and who I fear, I'm talking about David Duke. I'm talking about he is a demagogue from hell, and he is somebody that ought to be reckoned with.
Do you think he's going to win?
I think he's going to win.
Do you think he's going to win, Chris?
I was completely against this guy. I watched him on Phil Donahue today. I watched the entire show, and at the end of the show, I was saying, this guy is saying a lot of good stuff.
You know,
he was very impressive. Yeah.
Does he win?
Does he win,
Grayson?
He was talking.
Does he win, Grayson?
When Grayson answered,
I hope
that.
He was talking issues.
Well, the Democrats have got to hope that he wins, right?
No,
Politically?
No, no. That's absolutely wrong.
Really?
No. Just like we want to adjust me because.
I tell you what.
I'm not happy that they don't want to.
Wait a minute.
I tell you what. If David Duke wins, this is what scares me. If this guy wins, he's going to be in the primaries down south.
And
for president in 92 against George Bush.
And
he will be a tough candidate.
And I didn't see the Donahue show, but I did read a quote from that in the paper this morning. And after acknowledging the atrocities and oppression in Germany, he also said, and as well as the Soviet Union, he said, and I think there is a lot of blank, blank. The closest things I know to the policies of Germany in this country is the so-called affirmative action or quota systems. They had quotas in Germany as well as on the basis of race. I don't think you should have racial preferences.
You see, Greg,
and
apart from your anger on this.
Well, my anger is because it trivializes what happened there.
I understand, but let's back away because this is a program about procedures. Take a look at the demagoguery of this. Take a look at a guy who answers Edwin Edwards, the most passionate thing that Edwards had to say to win that argument. Will you denounce this kind of thing? And his answer is, I will when Jesse Jackson stops spitting in salad.
Which is a message that a lot of people relate to.
Last word to Bernie in California.
All right, Bernie,
you're a liberal, right? Can we say you're a liberal?
Yes, actually.
Liberal, you're talking to Cuomo. You got to be a liberal Democrat. Let's put a political hat on.
Like to the middle class.
Okay, but here's my
we
point.
We want the Democrats to come home to the Democratic Party.
What about David Duke? Does David Duke touch a political strain out in California that you run into? You're repulsed by it, but is it there?
I don't see it. Of course, you know I live in my own little world.
That's right.
But let me just say that David Duke doesn't represent the great middle class, the blue-collar workers like myself. He might maybe in the state of Louisiana.
I would say there's probably a few million people that would disagree with that.
I'm talking about national politics here, and I think that we want to stray with the whole Jesse Jackson point. All I'm trying to say about Jesse Jackson that if he were a white man from day one, he speaks to the social issues that the Democrats and the great middle America, the great American populace, the Democratic Party, want to hear. And it happened in Michigan, clearly, in the last election.
Bernie, thanks very much for calling from California.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We move on. This a quote from the President of the United States on David Duke. Quote, I believe that David Duke is an insincere charlatan. He's attempting to hoodwink. I haven't heard that for a long time. The voters of Louisiana, and I believe that he should be rejected for what he stands for. And Ron Brown, Democratic National Committee chairman, says, it's a disgrace, and I hope now that George Bush is going to spend a little time at home, that he go down there to Louisiana and try to make sure that David Duke is defeated in that race. Does anybody think that the president is going down to Louisiana to get involved more than he is already?
Of course he is not. And the sad thing is, it's a
Brown's trying to suck him into
a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think a lot of Democrats do want him to get elected.
When last night on the panel, all the so-called impartial journalists attacked Duke. And he sat there, and they all assailed him.
Every knock is a boost.
The Schottenbeer guy is saying, hey,
exactly,
what's wrong with this guy?
Nobody asked him about his facelift then?
No. They did on Phil Donahue today.
It doesn't hurt him.
Donahue just beat him and beat him. By the end of the show, people were clapping at everything he said.
See, this is the tragedy.
They're building up.
Liberals never know when to stop.
Right.
And they tend, when they go over the line, they build sympathy for the person they're attacking.
That's what happened on Donahue.
The moral from that lesson. The moral from this lesson is that what this man represents is evil and a lack of morality. That's the fact of the matter. And there's no one speaking out assuming a high moral ground. It really is appalling if the President of the United States puts party ahead of morality. If we had a moral leader who could step out and say, hey, this is outside of the lines, it appeals to the same white male instincts and the same racist symbolism that we saw in the Bush campaign.
But when he
says this,
it's a short distance from Willie Horton to David Duke.
That's
if anybody
right.
should have responsibility for David Duke,
David Duke is the son of George Bush.
I hate to remind you of history. Willie Horton was a rapist
that's
who
not
was
the
free.
Point.
No, no,
he committed rape.
No.
I don't think, Tom,
that's
you know that's not the point.
That's not what Grayson is saying, and you know it.
George Bush said, when someone has so recently endorsed Nazism, it is inconceivable that such a person can legitimately aspire to leadership in a leadership role in a free society. And when someone has a long record, an ugly record, of racism and of bigotry, that record simply cannot be erased by the glib rhetoric of a political
and George
campaign.
Bush thinks
quote.
That he can say it because he doesn't have the history. So he can say the same things that David Duke is saying.
We're moving on to Indiana. Go ahead, Indiana. You're on Inside Politics. Go ahead.
Great. May I make one comment on David Duke before I make a comment on senior citizens?
Yep.
I worked 20 years in community relations in the city of Chicago, and when you abolish racism in the white race, and you abolish racism in the black race, and you abolish racism in the brown race, the Hispanics, then I'll listen to you and believe what you say. You people better get to the street and find out what's happening, because you're living an isolated life. You don't know what racism is on your side of the microphone. Listen on the radio side and see what happens. I say that if George Bush does one thing, if he will lift the terrible weight of wage limitations on seniors who still must make a living because some of them didn't have the ability to put it away or married late in life, if he'll lift that wage limitation and if he'll take care of the notch people, George Bush will be reelected.
All right, on that note, we say goodbye to Pat in Indiana. And a reminder, if you'd like to have your pulse taken in the coming weeks, drop us a postcard to Inside Politics, 105 West Adams Street, 40th floor, Chicago, Illinois, 60603. Thank you very much for joining us on this, the inaugural effort of Inside Politics Nationwide. We would like to thank our guests this evening, Tom Roser, Grace Kamekowitz, Grayson Mitchell, and Chris Bowman. Thank you all for joining us around the table here in Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. This program is a Jenny B. production, came to you from Chicago. So long, everybody.